Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Live Well Bipolar. First of all, you guys, this is a very special episode because this is episode number 200 of the podcast. I am in shock that this is real life, and I have someone very special to introduce you guys to who I have brought on to Live Well Bipolar for us. Her name is Dr. Lauren Yang. She is a clinical psychologist in the Bay Area. She currently is providing individual and group therapy to adults in the Department of Psychiatry at Kaiser Permanente. Lauren also serves as associate board president and past vice chair of the Young Adult Council for the Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance. With her lived experience of bipolar 2 disorder, she has contributed to articles, podcasts, and panels. Her work can also be seen in International Bipolar Foundation, BP Hope Magazine, Grad School Femtoring, and Psych Explained with Dr. Jack. So Lauren, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm so excited to get into this. I know we've been having a lot of back and forth over email and all this stuff. So I'm happy the day's finally here.
Yes, absolutely honored. Like I said, Paris, to be here, to be your 200th episode of your podcast. Super excited, incredibly honored to be here. Thank you.
Of course. And yeah, I know it is so exciting to think back to just really the reason why I started this. And I think something super cool about your experience is you have that lived experience living with bipolar 2 disorder, but then also the work that you do as a clinical psychologist. So it really reminds me when I went back and worked in that same hospital I was a patient at, and something we're going to get into, you guys, that I was super excited to bring to you is Lauren's going to be getting into a little bit about what it was like for her to navigate disclosing as a grad student and then also working professional. But then also we're talking about what it looks like for Lauren to reduce the stigma and shame having this lived experience in the Asian American community. So as we're going to get into these topics, Lauren, I'd just like to pass it over to you to kick things off with a little bit before you received your diagnosis and kind of just lay the groundwork for what your life looked like back then prior to the diagnosis and then getting the diagnosis.
Yeah, absolutely. So to give a bit of a time frame here for folks, so that was 11 years ago for me now. I was a fourth year undergraduate student in college at UCLA, and it was spring quarter, I believe. So I was just starting to wrap up, you know, my time in college. The prospect of graduation was coming up and entering the quote unquote real world, so to speak. And I think I still, in thinking back on that time, try to pinpoint what was the trigger, what was the precipitating event, because I don't really, as far as I know, have family history or knowledge of anyone who has bipolar disorder or mood disorder of some sort. So, you know, mental health was just really not a concept for me growing up in my family. And this first hypomanic episode that I ended up suffering during that time really put mental health on the map for me, really put it on my radar. And so, you know, what that looked like was, of course, the sleepless nights. I was ready to go, go, go after 2-3 hours of sleep per night. I was coming up with like 60 plus ideas for this self-help blog that I thought was going to change the world at the time. Wanted to publish a book on top of that. I was checking out books upon books, you know, for this project from the campus library, you know, so just a snapshot of what that was going on for me at the time. And then irritability, rage really started to kick in. I think that's not so much talked about sometimes with the hypomania or mania aspect for us. But yeah, just when I started to notice I was really starting to be verbally aggressive and rage against, you know, my boyfriend at the time, college roommates, people, strangers out in public, you know, just really not being myself in that respect. I mean, not only were people around me concerned, but I was really taken aback by just how, you know, how aggressive I was being towards others. And so I took myself to my college counseling center. And that was my introduction to therapy, to psychiatric meds, even, from there. And that really just was the start of my mental health journey from there. And needless to say, it was not without its challenges. I can go more into, you know, anecdotes of that later if that we have time for that. But, you know, so when I eventually moved back home after graduating and, you know, just after coming off the hypomania, there was the depression, my first major depression, as well, you know, seeing peers and friends go off to medical school, professional school, with me not having a clear direction, no clear purpose of what I was going to do after college. So that didn't help. But I was able to move back home, and it really was a struggle to be able to, as a young adult, figure out how insurance worked, how to find in-network providers, figuring out the insurance reimbursement process, all of that. So long story short, I got that diagnosis with the second psychiatrist that I saw in that outpatient clinic that I went to after college. And yeah, just really went from there.
Wow. What age were you when you received the diagnosis?
22.
So with me, mine was 19 years old, but I remember feeling very similar to when you said you came back home and you said watching your peers going off into these different directions or having these clearly defined paths of either medical school or I'm continuing on here and not having that clearly defined for yourself. I really resonate because that's exactly how I felt, right? And I feel like, especially when you're school-wise, a very high achieving kind of person, right? You're very driven to do well in school. You like learning, you like these kind of environments. So it's frustrating when it's like, I've done all this work, but then I don't exactly know what this looks like. And then on top of that, to be dealing with, for the first time, like you shared, I don't have any family history that I know of bipolar disorder. So I feel like at least I did have that. So it wasn't as openly talked about, but I did know of it. So I could reference to kind of what that looked like. But then I'd also love to hear, because I know you mentioned having all these signs, you talk about the rage, the irritability, the sleepless nights, having all these ideas, right? The 60 ideas of starting a blog, writing a book, checking out all these books, doing all these things at once, right? And mm-hmm. I really felt that same exact way as well. And I think something that sticks out differently than me for you is you were aware of these things. And then you went into that counseling center and you said, that was my first experience with medication, with therapy, with all these things. For me, I just kept going and just didn't really have too much of that input. So I love to hear your perspective on that, because getting into the specifics, you're talking about the challenges that you faced, right? So I'd love for you to share maybe the top two that come to mind prior to getting the diagnosis, or maybe right after you got it, right? What was your reaction to finally knowing, okay, I live with bipolar 2 disorder?
Right. So I guess I should first say that I kind of self-diagnosed myself with just having Google and the internet like ready at our fingertips nowadays, or, you know, even back then, right? I was looking up the symptoms, bipolar came up in the search result, and no one else, even in talking to friends, roommates and my boyfriend at the time could really, like, they definitely couldn't confidently say what it was that was going on for me. But so, you know, brought that working diagnosis or idea of how to describe and label my experiences to the psychiatrist at the counseling center. And still to this day, one of the top challenges that I came to face within that process was being doubted in my, not specifically the symptoms, but the adverse side effects that I ended up experiencing when taking my first mood stabilizer. So I was pretty open, actually. Like, I wasn't too nervous or averse to considering psychiatric meds for myself. I just knew I wanted help pronto in some shape or form. So, you know, was game, ready for it. But before that, even, so before I was able to get the mood stabilizer in my hand, started taking it, when I went to CVS to go pick it up and not realizing, oh, you know, insurance information is needed to have it not cost $500+ and not feeling like I could talk to my parents at the time about what was exactly going on, why I needed to know more about my insurance information. In the end, got it. But, you know, I was crying, frustrated in the CVS, not knowing how to make heads, tails, or sense of this. And when I got went back later to be able to pick up the med and figured out the insurance stuff, the pharmacy tech said to me, oh, so no crying today. she recognized me from before when I was crying in frustration. And that was one of the things she said to me when I went to go pick it up. And yeah, so I'm sure, you know, whatever was going on for her at the time or whatever might've been behind her comment in that. But for me, again, and over 11 years ago, being able to remember that clear as day, that was a very shameful and vulnerable moment for me, to be told that at that time. So that was one. And then when I then started taking the mood stabilizer, after a couple of weeks, I started experiencing body aches, pains, to the point that I was pretty bedridden. Like I couldn't really get out of bed because of that. And then I was experiencing this widespread rash over my body and face. So my roommate and boyfriend, you know, fortunately was able to bring me to the emergency room and, you know, they gave me Benadryl and took care of that. But when I told the psychiatrist later about that reaction, she also doubted and said to me, are you sure that wasn't the flu? You weren't experiencing flu symptoms. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that wasn't very helpful either at the time.
Oh my gosh. I can't even imagine the things that can stick out to you years later. Cause I feel like I share that same exact thing. Cause I know for me, my diagnosis was 10 years ago. And there's certain scenarios that I remember those things that were said, like when you went to pick up your medication and you're like, I don't know how this works. Insurance works. I don't feel comfortable yet, you know, picking up the phone and telling my parents like, hey, I ordered this. And like, here's why I'm doing this, or here's what's going on with me. I felt very similar to that. So I feel like I remember just those earlier days and different things that were said to me that I still remember to this day, like the place I was, how I felt in my stomach, and how it still hits you to even talk about it today. I can't even imagine going in there and then going in again and having that comment, like just continue mm-hmm. to like reverberate inside your mind. And then really just how that continues to layer on the shame that you already have to begin with. You already have that going in there, but then it's like even more so of the people who were present, or taking that back to when you're going home. And then even, like you said, the other comment of getting rushed to the ER, having these bedridden body aches, rash, your face and your body, and then right away just being discounted and dismissed for, are you sure this wasn't the flu? Because I've also had that happen as well with just different providers when I kind of would bring up different things I'm feeling. And I feel like it's frustrating because you're just trying to communicate, this is what I'm going through, this is what I'm experiencing, here's what it is. And then without even an acknowledgement back of, I understand how frustrating that might feel, like any kind of, none of that. It was just like, oh, that's not this. It's, you don't even think about this. So I feel like I totally understand that. And I think I've even recently this year had that, you know, not so much with bipolar, but when I went through different health stuff with my stomach and symptoms that I was kind of bringing up and just being dismissed and just the same thing. So I think that like, I can totally relate to that. But I think something else that's interesting is I would love to hear your perspective on this. So whether you disclosed and told this to your parents of, here's what I've been dealing with, here's what's going on, how did that conversation start? Did they come to you? Did you go to them? I'd love to hear just the breakdown of that story.
Yeah. I think that part of this journey for me, it's, I think so much of it is still shrouded in a lot of like mystery, unspoken silence around it. Like there really hasn't been a lot of openness, transparency between myself and my parents and my family, really. So at the time, right, I mean, even though I had that working idea of a diagnosis, got confirmed later by another psychiatrist that it was bipolar 2 disorder, I never even voiced that diagnosis actually out loud to my parents. When I was getting therapy and still getting, med management after graduating, I just vaguely told them I'm having mental health issues. I need this and this. And so I was fortunate to be financially supported by them, if anything, and, you know, being able to still be on their healthcare insurance through Obamacare. Was able to access the help and treatment that I needed very much so in those early stages, right? And so I do want to recognize that they were able to provide that for me, if not the emotional support or conversation that could be had openly with them. And again, like I said, to this day, it's not even really something I talk about as open and as transparent as I am very much now about it, and can name these experiences as bipolar disorder. That's been like.
And I think too, just hearing you talk about when you mentioned it, right? You got the diagnosis and you said, here's what I'm dealing with. I'm going through mental health struggles and this is what I'm needing, and having that financial support from them. And I think that's kind of, for me, is going through that. I know it's different now. I feel like with time, 10 years have gone by and now it's just becoming more acceptable. I feel like the more we talk about it, the more we have these conversations. But again, I'd love to hear about just, because you mentioned it previously when we were talking, you said your environment and growing up, and this wasn't really talked about. So like you said, you would do a lot of Googling and you would find the symptoms and you had this diagnosis and you got it confirmed. So you were like, here's what's going on with me. I'm noticing things that are not typically part of my behavior, and you were doing the research on it. I think it's really interesting as well. Like, you talk about this happening while you were in grad school, and you were in grad school studying, you were studying psychology. Is that correct?
Oh, so, to back up. So this was all in the last year of undergraduate college. And then, you know, had 4 years, gap years, before entering grad school. So, that was technically during my undergrad years when this was all going down. Yeah.
And what were you studying there?
Psychobiology, actually.
Okay. And then you ended up transferring that. And then the graduate program was the one you just completed for the clinical psychology licensing. So that's
correct.
So did any of that come up in any of your classes, like anything related to that? Because I feel like for me, mm-hmm. I was studying psychology, so I would hear about, like, here and there sprinkled some things about bipolar, but I always thought that was what it was. But same thing with you. I was kind of always dismissed, and people would tell me, no, you don't have that because of some reason, right? Because mm-hmm. you're getting good grades, you're working two jobs, like whatever that is, right? Where you are basically presenting in a way that makes people think, no, you mm-hmm. can't be or have this thing because we think it's this other way. So
right.
I think, I mean, even when you mentioned that with your parents of the openness now, but then with the work that you're doing professionally. So I'd love to hear too, because you bring it up, growing up, this wasn't something we talked about. We didn't get into mental health. We didn't talk about these diagnoses. And I've heard this from other guests that I've spoken to, but I'd love for you to touch on this in your own words, right? What has that looked like for you, especially touching on the Asian American culture, what that has been like for you from your earlier years in terms of mental health?
Yeah. So I think growing up in a not only family household, but as I've gone to have more saliency and awareness around the cultural factors that have played into this for me, I think, first of all, there's a lot of shame and guilt that are rampant in Asian American cultures as it is. It's been used as a survival strategy, you know, being a minority in the U.S., you know, trying not to draw attention to ourselves, like speaking more for my parent and grandparent generation, right, who immigrated over, trying not to rock the boat, has been said. Really trying not to call any sort of attention, right? So shame, guilt, being sort of protective mechanisms for that. And then also to save face and preserve harmony within the group. So whether that be within the family unit, within our community, within society, right? So want to just name that, first of all, that shame and guilt is already such a prevalent thing in these cultures, and then of mine. And then you add in the internalized stigma of around mental health, which, you know, as you've spoken to, fortunately, is starting to lift a little bit more in recent years, especially as we're bringing these more to the forefront with these lived experience conversations and stories, again, as your podcast does so well in elevating. And yet, again, I think with there being a lot of indirect communication being typical in our cultures, the expression and acceptance of emotions and feelings not really being much talked about at all. And then the idea of help seeking is also considered a pretty big barrier for those of us in these cultures, where a lot of shame and isolation gets compounded by feeling like, okay, we need to keep this within the family. This is something that, or even more so, you know, on an individual level, right? Like for me, I felt like I really had to shoulder this on myself. I felt like I didn't want to bother my friends and family with this. I couldn't even really explain too well. I didn't have the language or, you know, the emotional literacy to be able to communicate to my friends and family, not only how to make sense of my experiences, but what it is that I need help, and what do support look like for me, which I can better articulate nowadays, you know, but as a young adult, that was just not in my vocabulary. And so all to say that, you know, I think with the, all these kind of factors that come from our cultures, and then it really depends if you're like first generation, second generation, the level of acculturation, you know, that you're in, all these things, right? So to bring it back to me though, personally, of like, that's just been an ever ongoing journey for myself, for sure, of how to learn how to be more direct in my communication, be more expressive and accepting of my feelings, be more okay with seeking help from others. So that's been its own journey for sure.
Wow. Yeah, that's really helpful to have that whole breakdown and just understand each of these components and how they all play together, right? And in perpetuating the shame that you feel, like you talk about internally, of I need to keep this within myself, and then also within the family to preserve that harmony, to save face, to make them proud, right? Whether it's my parents, my family, those around me who are looking up to me and saying, I'm so proud of you, you know, what you're doing with your work, your school, these accomplishments, but then feeling like, would they think less of me if I show this side of myself? If I really say, yes, I'm doing all these things, but I'm feeling constantly overrun by this stress, overwhelm. And what would that do to the relationship? What would that do to the household and to the community, right? That I'm trying to foster and continue to nurture, but then I feel like I'm slipping away from myself. So that really makes so much sense, especially when you talk about the shame and the guilt and those feelings together of feeling like that indirect communication and not getting too in depth into the emotions of when it is something that's going on, giving that person space, or not really wanting to ask too many questions. Cause you know, we might think if we ask too many questions, is that bothering them? Or am I a burden to put this out? So I really feel like that breakdown makes so much sense. And especially when you talk about it from a cultural standpoint and saying whether you're first generation, second generation, but then also as a minority already, you already have different things stacked against you. And I'm not wanting to bring this to the table of, okay, so now you're saying you're dealing with this, or this is just another factor that's causing something else, right? So that breakdown is really helpful to understand, right? Of why is it different from an Asian American standpoint versus someone else who's white or whatever background that you are from, right? Or the environment in which you're raised in, how is that different? And how does that impact our early years? And then also our parents, right? How were our parents raised around us? How was our grandparents raised? And I think it comes back to what you're saying is breaking that cycle of normalizing the conversations. And I think that's why I'm so happy to have you on the podcast right now, is because you're doing it, right? You could literally have continued to keep this inside of yourself, but then also do the work that you're doing professionally and not even get into this topic of here's my personal experiences. Cause I feel like I did that as well. When I remember in college, like you said, that comment of no crying today when you went in to pick up your medication. I remember I had someone in college, they were studying for the MCAT, and they were asking me, how come you know all this stuff? And I would always lie and be like, well, I tutor people in psychology. I'm in the honors college, all these different face value things. I wanted to come out and be like, I know the difference between bipolar one and bipolar two because I live with bipolar one and I've gone through a hospitalization, but I would never do that. I would never go there. And meanwhile, I'm hiding my medications in a cabinet, trying to take them when my roommate's not there. And now this person who was my roommate in college is one of my best friends. And I'm actually going to be seeing her this week, flying out to New York for my birthday, but she's a doctor actually. So she's just completing her residency, but she said, I'm so happy the work that you're doing and that you're so open, because I had no idea that you were going through what you were going through. And I would have been there supportive no matter what, but it's inside of our minds, right? When you talk about the bipolar brain and how we don't want to like you said, rock the boat, or even I didn't even know at the time how to explain what I was feeling or put into words. So I really love that breakdown. It was so helpful, but I really want to hear about the work that you're doing today. You are a licensed clinical psychologist. Was there one thing that really swayed you to say, this is what I want to do professionally?
Yeah, it's hard to say if I can pin it on any one single thing. It really was a constellation, amalgamation of things for me, if I can speak to each of those briefly. Because in those four gap years that I had between undergrad and entering grad school, for the first 2 years, I would consider those still my denial years, where I was still in the pre-med mindset, like, I'm still going to pursue that. I'm interning, I'm gaining volunteer hours still towards that. But one of the shifts that happened or contributed to the shifts for me was, so I studied, took the MCAT, did okay on it. But I realized after all of that, that my heart really was not in this process. Like, I was not jazzed about prepping my applications for med school. So that sort of stopped me short. I was like, there's something there. Secondly, I had a professor mentor towards the end of my time in college. I only took like one elective course with her, but she, to this day, I actually still remain in contact with her. She very much so was a figure of encouragement for me to pursue a doctorate in psychology. She really pushed that for me. She really saw something in me, I think, that she felt like compelled, I really need to pursue a higher ed degree in psychology. So that was a second piece to it. And then the third that really locked it in for me and was the final piece to the puzzle was, so in the last 2 years of those gap years, I was able to work as an assistant in outpatient treatment centers in LA. And it really was the one-on-one interactions and experiences that I had, even not in a clinical role by any means yet, but really being able to support, bear witness, you know, to people's vulnerabilities and have them share their emotional struggles with me. I felt really privileged. I continue to, in this work that I do, feel honored and privileged to be able to be that kind of person to other people in vulnerable, challenging times of their life. And I still think about some of those people to this day that I worked with at that time. So yeah, it was really a combination of things for me.
Wow. I love just the outline of those three things. It's really cool to see how you talk about moving into something that was on your heart, right? And feeling the denial stage. And then even admitting that, saying, I went through this and I'm going to do pre-med, I'm going to pursue this, but then saying, I'm not excited about this. This doesn't light me up or bring me joy to work on these applications. And then even think about long-term future-wise, right? This isn't where I feel like I'm going to be happy. I'm not going to be able to provide that for what I'm wanting to do. So I think that that's a really big thing to, first of all, discover, but then also to shift your direction on pursuing what is it that I enjoy. And like you say, having those people around you who see that vision in you before you fully can see in yourself. So having that mentor, the professor you talked about saying, pursue a doctoral of psychology and going after this, and then really starting to consider, if that's something I want to do, I'm going to get involved in it and see what I can do. And like you talk about those last 2 years working in the outpatient treatment center, but then also remembering those conversations, remembering those people who were there, but then also saying, this is really what I'm here for, to be able to encourage people along the path of supporting these vulnerable moments, but then also offering the solution. So I feel like that's so brings me so much hope for people out there listening who might be in the same position right now. Maybe they're listening to this and they're also living with bipolar disorder, or they're continuing to feel like they have to mask in a professional capacity of, I want to pursue this career, I want to do this thing, but I don't know if I can't do it, right? Or if I will enjoy it. So I feel like very similar to what you've done is, you know, knowing that it's okay to not have figured out just yet, but I took the time, I did the work, and now I know exactly what I want to do. And I feel like that's so true for all of us. I felt that same way when I came out of school, is I went through all those different things. And I feel like someone else told me it so well, is there's so many stages in our lives where we reinvent ourselves and we can pursue different passions. And I totally get to the being bogged down by feeling like watching everyone around you. And especially when you're graduating college and you're going these different directions and feeling like I should have it figured out. But looking back now, it's, if you had pursued that, right, you wouldn't be here today. We wouldn't know each other. We wouldn't be having this conversation and we wouldn't be bringing this to the world, because who knows where you would have gone or where you would have been, you know, had you not pursued really what you enjoy. So I'm glad that you did it. I'm glad that you're doing the work that you're doing and that you're showing up online and sharing these findings, whether it's from your life personally, from the research that you've done, from your education that you've had. So something I always love to ask everyone on this podcast is, everyone always brings such a unique answer and perspective to this. So I would love to hear from you. If you think about the name of this podcast, right? So Live Well Bipolar, what does that mean for you right now at this point in your life?
Yeah. So great question. And I love that. Again, this is that's your podcast, shining beacon of hope and message in what it is that you promote through this platform that you give and offer to all of us here in this community. So first of all, just thank you for that. And secondly, I think, so wellness to me is not a destination, right? But a way of living. It's a lifestyle. It's an ever ongoing process, right? And I see it as multidimensional. It's not just the mental, emotional, it's also the physical, the social, professional, financial, spiritual, all of those domains, right? And so Live Well Bipolar to me is considering, how does bipolar as one aspect, one of many aspects that make up us as a person, you know, how does that fit into all these other dimensions, all these other aspects for us, right? Mm-hmm. So for a lot of us with bipolar disorder, of course, it's a very huge aspect. It, you know, for me, it certainly felt bigger, more at the forefront at certain times, more than not, especially in the early years, right, that I was dealing with it. But I also truly believe that we are more than our diagnosis. We do not have to be limited or defined by bipolar disorder alone. Again, it's just one aspect of us. So I like to think about, how does it fit in with these other aspects of myself? You know, for me, I manage bipolar with still ongoing therapy, still on taking my medications, getting good sleep, taking care of my basic needs, all of that, which in turn enable me to feel fulfilled in these other domains of my life, my relationships, my career, my sense of self. Because when it comes down to it, I really do think that for us to be authentic, I think you promote and talk about this in your other episodes as well, being our authentic selves and being able to share all of who we are, which includes bipolar, is how I think about what that means to me.
I love that. And it's such a beautiful response, because I like how you talk about the different dimensions, but then also where does that fit in, right? When we're talking about what it means to live well bipolar, how does that trickle into these other components, right? Feeling fulfilled as a person in my career, in my relationships. And like you talk about these things that I do to manage therapy, medication, sleep, having these different components. I think that that's so important, because you talk about wellness is a way of living, a lifestyle. It's something that we're never going to be done with. And I love that you talk about that we are not our diagnosis. We're more than our diagnosis. And really just the whole overarching theme of why I started Live Well Bipolar is to show these stories, because I feel like it's always the stories is what has saved my life and what has given me hope. Like you mentioned, this being a beacon of hope, it's what got me to see that each of us, our experiences has so much value than what we see it as. And we all have a story inside of us right now that if we tell that story, it can save our lives, but then also put people on that path and on that trajectory of something they've been searching for so long. So I absolutely love what you just shared. I cannot wait to bring it to the world and really just see this response and how this is going to be helpful, because your story, I feel like, is so powerful, especially hitting on what we did of talking about the Asian American culture, the background, growing up around what mental health was like in the home, and really just how you've done this work to really make it more normalized. And then also for your communities and for other people who are sitting there listening and saying, I don't know a lot of other Asian Americans out there who are open about living with bipolar disorder. So now you are one of those people. You are one of those faces of someone that someone can look to, also a professional in the space, someone who is a licensed clinical psychologist who has dedicated her life to being that support for people in these vulnerable moments, but then also not being afraid to share your own, not being afraid to come out here and say, this is what I went through in my earlier years, and this is what it looked like for me. This is the good, the bad, the ugly, and here's what I do today to manage that. I think that this is so important because this is literally why I'm doing what I'm doing. And I'm so honored and thankful for you to come on and be the 200th episode of yes. Live Well Bipolar. So I want to just pass it back for you to tell everyone, where can they go to connect with you and get more of you and your work?
Absolutely. So I am very much active on Instagram. That's one major channel that folks can follow me on. The handle is at Dr. Lauren Yang, Dr. Lauren Yang. And I am soon launching my website that people will soon be able to visit as well, drlaurenyang.com, which will, it'll have a bunch of things. I won't spoil it, but it will share more about myself and my story, what I can offer to folks out there, not only as a licensed clinical psychologist, but in the advocacy realm, in the speaking realm even. So that's to come soon. And yeah, I always welcome DMs on Instagram. People can connect with me on LinkedIn as well. Yeah, very happy to be able to just connect with others and share in these experiences. So thank you, Paris, for this opportunity.
Of course. And thank you for coming on. I'll have all that information in the show notes. And you guys, please, if you're not already, go and connect with her. I'll have her information there for you to connect and see the work she's doing through the advocacy and really just professionally her own lived experience and everything we heard today. So Lauren, I want to thank you again for making the time to come out here on Live Well Bipolar and share your experiences with us. I feel like I can talk to you for hours and hours and days on these topics and just get into more of these details surrounding this. But I think that this conversation was so helpful and is going to be such a tool to so many. So thank you for making the time to come out here and share this.
Thank you so much. And congratulations again.
Yes. And everyone, thank you for being here. Whether you are listening to this for yourself or for a loved one living with bipolar, you are a big part of that work and you are already making an impact by showing up and being here today. So I want to thank you guys for always tuning in and being here to take away the big takeaways I share for you in these conversations. So on that note, I want to end it and say bye to you guys and bye to Lauren. So bye guys. Bye Lauren.
Bye. Take care.